laughing, almost loving pranam at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to the first episode of 2019 of the Afternoon Satsang. A very, very happy new year to each one of you. It's always a pleasure to be with all of you, and I don't know, we started this program in 2014, so this is probably the fourth or fifth new year we're celebrating with all of you. It's such a delight to come to all of you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. We most humbly offer our gratitude at Swami's lotus feet for giving us this opportunity to connect with all of you, because there's nothing more beneficial on the spiritual path than satsang. And that opportunity we are having only because of listeners like you. So a heartfelt gratitude to all of you, even as we begin this fresh new year, 2019. We only hope and pray that Swami gives us more such opportunities and gives us the strength to utilize to the maximum these opportunities that Swami gives us. As always, Arvind and Prema here at studio in Prashanti Nilayam, and we're coming to you live, and we're going to continue with the conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, the satsang that we do on a fortnightly basis. We had one episode last week, so we have to continue it this week before we take a break for a general theme next week. But before we do that, and before we give you a short summary of what we said last week, I'll ask Arvind to join in, because he would like to greet all of you too on this new year.
Yes, Prem, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Wish you a beautiful, wonderful, fulfilling and happy 2019. May our love for Swami in 2019 be more than the love we had for Swami in 2018. As Swami says, of course, there is no need to wait for a new year. Swami actually goes to the level of seconds, and he says that every second is new, and therefore you need not wait for a particular day or event. But though we know that every second is new, we are human beings and we are creatures who love to treasure and cherish things that are rare. And therefore, when we have once in a year event, we find it very special. We find once in 10 years event even more special, and an event once in a century even more special. And it's possibly because of that we don't celebrate each and every second. So, for us also, the new year, which comes once in a year, is a beautiful event, and I'm sure that all of us would have made our own new year resolutions to imbibe things or to give up things. But I think one resolution that we should always have in our heart, one deep yearning that we should always have in our heart, that our love for Swami should keep growing every passing year, every passing month, every passing week, every passing moment. So, with that, once again, welcome to today's Afternoon Satsang. Last week, we spoke on different themes, if I can say so, because though it was the same interview that Swami was granting to Hislop and a few others who had accompanied him, the topics moved from Swami speaking to the farmers about a purchase of land, then from there, Swami speaking about driving the car, how man should be responsible, how man can't be reckless and put the blame onto God. It went on like that. Finally, towards the end of last week's discussion, there was a question which Hislop asked about the Shashtabdi Purti ceremony, which is the marriage, the remarriage, the second marriage that is conducted as per the Bharatiya traditions for couples once the husband or wife attains the age of 60. And Hislop had asked Swami why that ceremony is done, and Swami had beautifully explained how, you know, 60, 70, 80, what's the significance of each decade in human life and what should be the goals. This is so beautiful. We have 5-year planning by countries, we have 5-year planning by companies, where they try to find out where they will be 5 years from now. And Swami has actually given us decadal planning for every stage of our life. At 10 years what we must do, 20 years what we must do. We went into quite some detail with respect to that. Today actually we will begin with a fresh question. It's a fresh question, but it's part of the same interview, because as Swami speaks about all these rituals and the importance of each decade, there is an Indian visitor who asks Swami, "Swami, these Hindu rites, is there anything to them?"
Yes, when the discussion about the marriages and all were going on, I think that is where this question has come. Swami, in one sentence, answers this question of, you know, what is the basis of all the rituals that is done? What is the basis of all the puja that is done? I think in some context during the afternoon satsang, we did have a discussion about that, maybe as part of the Bhagavatavahini satsang. Swami tells here that all of this, probably I'll just read out that passage where Swami's answer is, and so we can discuss about that. Swami says, we owe debts of gratitude, and this gratitude must be expressed at the appropriate time and in such a way as will enable the message to be delivered. Our gratitude is due to the two parents, Guru, God, nature, and the sages. If a letter is sent correctly addressed, it will reach its destination, and one need not know about or worry about the transit terminals through which the letter passes en route. In the case of the parents, their bodies have died, but the Atma has suffered no change. The correct address for the expression of gratitude is provided by the mantras used in the ceremony. Mantras are very powerful, and in olden days they were relied upon. Nowadays machines are relied upon. The experts in mantras are called saints. The experts in machines are called scientists. So that's Swami's reply, but as we can see, there are two or three themes which Swami speaks about there. But the first one, with regards to the rituals, the Hindu rites, and in fact any other religious rites that we tend to perform, Swami says the basis of that is gratitude and nothing more than that. The desire to and a means of expressing gratitude is what is packaged in the form of religious rites and festivities, if you could put it that way.
You know, when we look at a thing like gratitude, it feels like any other spiritual activity we do, whether it is seva or whether it is bhajan. On the face of it, it looks like it is benefiting somebody. It is something that is good to do. You know, when I do seva, the poor, the distressed, the sick, the weak, they get benefit from it. That's what I feel. When I sing bhajans, for instance, the atmosphere around changes, and therefore the vibration, the vibes change. That's why possibly we feel more peaceful when we go to a place of worship, like a church, a temple, a mosque, anywhere like that. Even the samadhi of a saint or a sage, we feel good because the vibrations there are good, we say. And we feel that by singing bhajans and participating in bhajans, we are helping create this vibration and helping create this atmosphere from which others can benefit from. So, in this manner, anything that we do spiritual or anything that we do as, even in this case, expressing our gratitude, it looks like it's a good thing to do because it benefits others. But if we go deeper into all these practices, we will realize that definitely others are benefiting, but that's only the side benefit, because we benefit the most. When I do bhajans, I am benefiting the most from bhajans more than the atmosphere or environment or others. In the same way, when I do seva also, it is I who am in need of that seva, because as Swami says, it is by doing seva. You know, once Swami even modified the popular bhajan, Hari bhajana bina sukha shanti nahi, into jana seva bina sukha shanti nahi. Because the amount of, impact that seva has on me, in terms of me overcoming my ego, overcoming this dehabhimana, coming to the realization of the truth that all are one, in order to reinforce this inside me, within me, seva is a very, very straightforward thing to do. And it happens so unconsciously. I may not even be aware of, the theoretical, the theory behind all being one, and you know, it is the same Atma pervading everyone. Even without doing all this, when I just do seva, that wisdom somehow seems to arise in me. And that's why we have come across many people, we have interviewed a few of them also, where people have got attracted to Swami because of the seva. It is natural. Either way, you know, if you get attracted to Swami, you love God, you automatically start doing seva. If you get attracted to seva, you automatically begin to love God, because they are two processes that reinforce each other. So, what I'm coming to is, when we do any of these, we benefit the most. Though on the face of it, we are possibly told to do it because it benefits others, it is good, we feel good. Even when we take it as it is benefiting others, suppose I do help to someone and it benefits them, it actually makes me feel good seeing somebody feeling better. So even there, subtly it is about me feeling good only. But ultimately it's about my own benefit. And I feel that is the case even with gratitude. When we express gratitude, when which starts off at a at a superficial level or at a surface level with simple thank you or I'm grateful to you for this, it might look like something we are doing which makes the other person happy, but this attitude of gratitude, as they call it, is something very, very powerful in transforming our own lives. We can go on about it, but they have found that even in the case of cancer patients, for example, those that are grateful, you know, rather than a person who gets up and says, I have got only 2 more years, what is the use, I'm gone, others are enjoying such long lives and I'm going to die in 2 years. You compare that person with another person who gets up and says, wow, this cancer could have killed me now, but it has given me 2 years. I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for these 2 years and I'm aware of these 2 years. It has been found that many patients who are either optimistic or have this attitude of gratitude, whatever you call it, have better chance of survival. They live far beyond the 2 years. In fact, those who are not having that attitude of gratitude even die out before the 2 years. So, it is so powerful even in the physical sense, definitely in the mental sense, and absolutely in the spiritual sense. So, when we owe debt of gratitude, as Swami says, and we pay this gratitude, again, we have to pay this debt of gratitude not as something we are doing for world welfare. It is for our own good. Unknown to us, it helps us in ways we cannot imagine. Now, isn't that what is the basis of even the Bhagavata? It is a person who got to know that he is going to die in 7 days, and instead of mourning, lamenting, cursing and telling what on earth is happening, how could life be so unfair to him, he looked up at the Supreme Being in gratitude and said, thank you that I know at least that I've got 7 more days. It gives me perspective, it gives me opportunity to prioritize my life. And that Raja Parikshit has given us the entire Bhagavata today, and he is a role model for us to follow, because he attained the ultimate salvation or moksha because of this attitude of gratitude. And therefore I think that though Swami quickly tells it in 3 sentences, it holds a secret to life. If only we can imbibe this attitude of gratitude, we can see life getting better and better with each passing moment.
And when we talk about this, Swami relating expression of gratitude to rituals. And if you look at it, all the festivals that we celebrate, it is all a means of thanking some form of nature or the other. You know, in another few days we're going to have the Sankranti festival. Some would say it is thanking the sun for what it's offering. Or you would have these seasonal festivals, because now not many of them are popular in the cities, but you know, there are festivals that are offered to the rain god, there are festivals that are offered to spring, there are festivals that are offered to the ocean, to the river, which are very, very regular and rampant all over. And, you know, I think we had spoken about this when we were talking about the Govardhanagiri episode in the Bhagavatam, where, you know, they were offering worship to Indra, who was the lord of the rain. But what had happened is, over a period of time, it had kind of degraded to the level of fear of the god, saying that if we don't do this, what will happen? So we better offer and we'll appease him. And Krishna comes into the picture and says, no, let's not do this. Look at the Govardhanagiri. Whatever we are being sustained by this mountain, and you know, our cattle graze there. The cattle give us milk, and that is what gives us prosperity. So let us thank this Govardhanagiri and let us do this worship. And in the process of that, story is that he kind of puts Indra in his place. But the other thing is, he kind of reorients this approach of the festival itself, saying that it is not to be done out of fear, it is not to be done out of what will happen if we don't do this and the elements will be upset with us, but it's meant to be done as an expression of gratitude. And when you talk about gratitude, the other most important thing, because you know, a lot of us as youngsters, especially if you turn spiritual, you tend to think that, oh, everything is God. Why do I need to thank anybody else? Why do I need to be grateful to anybody else? It is not a wrong attitude to have, but what does having this gratitude do to us, especially when you're talking about Swami is saying here about doing rituals even to your pitrus, those parents and grandparents and ancestors who have moved on. You kind of acknowledge that whatever I am today is because of the contribution of all of these people. If not for them, I cannot be doing what I am doing right now.
It makes one humble also.
Right, one makes one humble, and most importantly, it reduces doership. The whole process of spirituality is to ensure that your doership is reduced. In fact, there is that very beautiful episode in the Mahabharata at the end of the war when Arjuna kills Karna, and then he realizes that Karna is his elder brother when his mother comes crying. So Arjuna starts lamenting. He says, "Oh my God, I've killed my own elder brother. I'm such a sinner." And he looks at Krishna and says, "You know, you have conspired all this while you knew it, but you never told me. So I have killed my elder brother." So Krishna comes and says, "What are you crying about?" He says, I've been the killer of my elder brother." So then Krishna tells him, "Do you know that six people have already killed Karna?" And then he tells about all those curses that Karna has. He says, you know, Indra comes and takes away the armor which he has. And then there is the Brahmin who curses him that, you know, the earth will give way at a time when he needs it most. And his guru curses him saying,
Parashurama
says that you'll forget. So then Krishna says, "See, all of these people have contributed to his death. And you saying that I have killed that person is like, you know, stamping on a dead snake and saying that, oh, I have killed the snake." One way of looking at it is Krishna is telling that, you know, it's foolish to think that you are the doer. But even when you talk about our achievements, when we say that, you know, if today I am something, if I'm a president of a company or if I'm, you know, a successful lawyer or a doctor, starting from our kindergarten, people have contributed to what we are today. And when we remember that with gratitude, we are actually, you know, reducing this doership so much that humility comes out of the reduction of the attitude of doership. And that is why it is so important, and that's what Swami is saying here, that you should be grateful to all of these people. And of course, the next part of that answer which Swami is giving is about, you know, the mantras being a means of taking your prayers to the people who are no more in their physical body in that sense.
And when we look at the statement that Swami uses, the experts in mantras are called saints, the expert in machines, I think Swami must have said yantras.
Yantras
are called scientists. So, it's almost like Swami saying, just like a scientist trusts his machine, his equipment, his whatever in the laboratory it is there, that's how the saints trusted the mantras. And what I could gather from the whole thing is that though there are rituals, Swami is always trying to tell us to understand the spirit behind the ritual. And that is what we had spoken about briefly last week also, that it is the spirit behind the ritual that makes anything spiritual. If that spirit is forgotten, the ritual becomes meaningless. And that is what happened in the case of the Govardhana Hill, where Krishna told that, "You don't even know why you're doing this ritual. Do you know why you're doing the ritual? No, the spirit is wrong. If the spirit is gone, then the ritual is a meaningless ritual. Therefore, let's change it. Imbibe the spirit, then anything you do becomes spiritual." I'm reminded of a little story I read about how a child goes and stands in front of God and says, "God, I would love to pray to you, but I don't know any prayers. And therefore, I know that all the prayers are made up of the alphabets. So I'll tell the alphabet 10 times. You can make the prayer because you know it anyway." This is so sweet, and I'm sure God would have been very pleased with that little child and happy. So in that child's innocence, in the child's love for God, keeping with the spirit of prayer, the child possibly made its own ritual, you know, of standing in front of God and telling the alphabet 10 times. But it is spiritual. It is more spiritual than the cowherds at Nanda Gokula worshipping Indra out of fear that rains may not be there. Because, once again, coming back to the same statement, it is the spirit behind the ritual that makes it spiritual. And if we wish to be spiritual beings, we should know the spirit behind every ritual we do. And when I say ritual, if we can just broaden our vision, it's not just those specific pujas or worships that we do that we should consider as ritual. The ritual of our daily life, of our daily living, brushing my teeth. In fact, Swami has gone to an extent saying, when you're taking bath, think that you're giving Abhishekam to the Lord. When you're brushing your teeth, think that this is the place from which food goes to the Lord, and therefore you have to sanctify it. You know, so when Swami speaks of ritual, it is not just that ritual that I do for half an hour or 1 hour or once in a year or once in a month during a festival. Every action that we do, everything that ritual basically is something that we do on a regular basis. Every day that I do. So if I go for my games every day, if I get up and have my bath, if I go to office, each of these is a ritual. When we do each of these rituals, we should remember the spirit behind it and do it with that spirit in mind. And then that ritual itself becomes spiritual. Swami, that's why he says, transform your work into worship, transform your duty into God.
And if you really go into some of these rituals in the sense of the incantations which go with them, the Sanskrit mantras, I mean, today we look at them as mantras which are being chanted in a certain way, and you know, one might wonder that I don't know those rituals. I mean, I don't know those mantras, so I cannot make my ritual perfect. If you go into the meaning of especially some of these rituals which Swami is referring to, it would be nothing but just speaking to the deities in that language, right? And it's nothing but saying that I'm doing this, I might be doing mistakes in this, but please forgive me and accept this offering. I'm doing it with all my heart. I'm doing as much as I could, and I'm thanking you for... I think at the end of the day, that's what matters. You might be chanting all of that, but if you're not having that attitude which that prayer is trying to convey, then there's no point in that. So, I mean, when you said that thing of a little child going and making that prayer, it might not have made the prayer in Sanskrit, or it might not have made it in probably, you know, Hebrew or any such language
which
we consider godly. Right? But the attitude was the same. It was trying to convey something to the Lord with the belief that what I'm saying is reaching the Lord. I think that is what is most important. And the reason why we have given up rituals is that, you know, how can someone who has passed away receive what I'm giving? You know, I'm putting food in front of a picture. How can it reach? In fact, you know, Swami does not miss the opportunity to say that. He says, your mother and father are eternal. It's only the body that perishes. You know, even while talking about these rituals, Swami does not say that you can forget that fact. You have to remember that the soul is eternal and it is not your mother and father. But still, it is not wrong to do these rituals because you are expressing your gratitude.
It reminds me of a story which is commonly attributed to Swami Vivekananda, wherein a king or a ruler, somebody calls him and asks him, what is the meaning of these worshipping stones as God? And he asks, do you think that what I put in front of the stone actually reaches God? I mean, why do people do all this? It is said that Swami Vivekananda goes and spits on a painting of the father of this king or emperor or ruler, whoever he is. And that enrages the king. And Swami Vivekananda asks him, why are you getting so enraged? Do you think that this painting is nothing but a canvas? Do you think that my spit is actually going to reach your father? So then he says, it is not about the act itself, but it's about the feeling that is conveyed with the act and the feeling that the act arouses in others. That's why Swami would say, yad bhavam tad bhavati. What you feel, so you become. If you consider that it is the same thing. You spit in a spittoon, it's not considered anything bad. But you spit on a person's photograph, it's considered most demeaning, most hurtful, most insulting. So that is what it is. And I think as long as we are in a state of mind, or we are in that level of spirituality where I find difference between top and bottom, between sand and foot, between people dear to me and people far from me. In other words, I am still not in a stage of Advaita where I can see the same divinity in present in all. Till I reach that stage, I think all these rituals are important, because it's like, again, my favorite example of the drama. When I'm acting in the drama, as long as it is within the confines of the drama, all the relationships there, all the props there, I know that it's not, I mean, in the reality, I know it's not a tree. But in the drama, it's a tree and it serves as a tree. And everything that I need to do along with the tree, for the tree, I need to do it in the drama. So as long as I'm still in that drama of life, I need to do all these things, these rituals, expressing my gratitude, everything. And that is what Swami is saying here. And as Swami concludes the whole the answer to that question with the statement that the experts in mantras are called saints and the experts in yantras are called scientists, there is a visiting scientist in that group who now raises a doubt about science regarding what Swami said. You know, he The doubt has not been registered here, but what Hislop writes is, a visiting scientist now raised a doubt about science vis-a-vis what Swami had said. And then Swami continues to answer. And Swami says, science is highly fragmentary and its approach to reality is through Maya. And this is a highly dangerous practice. Science does not even know the truth of chemistry and physics. Each 10 years or so, the old truths are discarded or modified because of research results. So when man tries to compare science and the spiritual world of Baba, he is comparing a science whose finality is not known with spiritual truth of which also he is ignorant. Science is from the senses downward. Spirit is from the senses upward. Science does not even know of the great holes in the sun through which winds rush to regulate the temperature. Science is hit and miss. For one to really know, he must have the total overall knowledge of Baba.
And this is something which many times Swami has spoken. I think even in the conversations with Hislop, this had featured some time back about science being limited in its approach. The other thing which Swami would often tell in his discourses is about science being a C or, you know, half circle and spirituality being the full circle. It's very difficult to explain this to a scientist because you're constantly looking at the world from the mind. And, you know, there's a very beautiful statement that Swami makes here that he says science's approach to reality is through Maya. And there's a beautiful description I had read somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They said why the Atma is beyond the ken of the mind. Right? Mm. They say one of the qualities of the Atma is it does not change. The mind can understand things only that change.
Mm.
Right? And according to Vedanta, that which changes is Maya. So when Swami says here, the mind can only approach reality through Maya, it says that the science can only read that which changes. And if you look at it, all our scientific study is based on things that change and modify. And, you know, there's whether it's a change in temperature or change in form or change in chemical status, all our measurements are like that. You know,
measurement itself depends on change.
Yes.
If there's no change, there's no measurement.
Absolutely. And that's why they say that the tool of science itself is to measure something which changes. And you're talking about something which is changeless. The spirit is changeless, so the science can never understand that. But try telling this to a scientist. I think it would be impossible to drive that lesson home.
No, actually, Prem, I think scientists themselves are waking up to it because recently as 1 week back, I saw a Washington Post article. Okay, and it was an article on cholesterol. And it was saying that the American Medical Association is now saying that cholesterol in foods is a farce, no problem. And that article goes on to say that, you know, 45 to 50 years of what we have beaten drums about and told people to be aware of is actually turning out to be false. I mean, it is not as if you can eat all fatty substances and all. The body still produces cholesterol and that cholesterol causes blocks. But saying that the cholesterol that has caused blocks in your arteries or near your heart is because of the cholesterol that came from this food, apparently, it's a farce. I mean, so for 50 years, the diets that have been done, and in fact, there was also a figure which runs into a few trillion dollars, saying that is the amount of dollars that has been sunk into something that is not true. You know, and when I was reading this, I just felt this is atrocious. How can you do this? You know, for 50 years, the whole world believed you, swore by you. Every doctor said that, everybody prescribed it, everything happened. And now one sudden day you say that it's not true. And that is what Swami is saying here. He's saying each 10 years or so, the old truths are discarded or modified because of your research results. I mean, if you go back 500 years or more, I don't know exact time, but when Copernicus came and said that the sun is the center of the solar system, everybody thought he's a heretic. I think they wanted to kill him or punish him. And that how on earth can you say that the earth is not the center? The earth was not just considered as the center of the solar system or something like that. It was considered as the center of the universe. I think it actually points to a deep-rooted sense of ego that we all have. Each of us feels that we are the center of the universe, you know. We are the most important beings. We feel that we have such a high level of self-importance. And it exhibited a little more openly back then, possibly. That's why they felt that the earth is the center of the whole universe. And today we laugh at them. The people who were ready to kill the only person telling the truth... today are being laughed at. So today, when somebody says God exists, God is most powerful, God does this, the majority of the world may laugh at them. But how are you so sure that 200 years from now, the world then, in the future, will not be laughing at these people who laughed at this concept? Therefore, it is absolutely relatable, and I'm sure that a modern day scientist will be able to relate with that, because communication has improved so much today, and interconnectedness between countries, between researchers, between even subjects, you know, like it's no longer biology, physics or chemistry. We have biophysics, we have physical chemistry, we have biochemistry. It's all becoming one. It's just fusing into something called life sciences. The way this is happening, the communication is so fast. I'm sure scientists today realize that, yes, it's all changing. What is winning me an award or a Nobel Prize today may be a Nobel, you know, nothing, no bells in that kind of prize 2 years down the line. So it is absolutely true that science is also changing because it is a study of things that are changing. And that's why Swami says that you can't compare science and spirituality, because science is something that's constantly changing, you're absolutely unsure of. And spirituality also you have no idea about, because you have not explored it. So you are in no way qualified to compare these two, because you have no knowledge of either of them. In fact, that's why, you know, when Swami would speak about truth, in English it's made of as truth, but Swami would use different terms. He would use the terms Nijam or Satyam. And when Swami explains it, it's so easy to understand. Nijam is something like a fact or something like the truth of the present. For instance, I can say that Usain Bolt is the Olympic champion, 100 meters champion. It is true today. It is the truth. But 10 years before, it was not the truth. 2 years later, it might not be the truth. In the next Olympic, it might cease to be the truth. And therefore, these kind of truths, which hold true only for the present, not for the past or future, Swami would refer to as Nijam. And if we extrapolate this, you know, Prem, there's no end to it. For example, Mount Everest is the tallest mountain in the world. It holds good today and it held good 100 years ago. But what about 5,000 years ago? It possibly didn't hold good then. What about 5,000 years from now? If we keep expanding the scale of time, we see that even the entire universe, the creation, the Big Bang, everything comes under Nijam. Because it's only in a certain period of time that it holds true. And the quest of life is to find that Satyam. That's why Swami says, Trikala Badhyam Satyam. Satyam, truth is something that is changeless in the three periods of time. And when Swami says three periods of time, it is not the Jurassic era, the Mesozoic era, not like that. The three periods of time are the past, the infinite past, the infinite present, and the infinite future.
You know, when you're talking about the idea of the interdisciplinary approach to science catching up, and what Swami is saying, science, you know, looks at everything, that's a clear thing that you can see. The approach that has changed now in the scientific field, because if you read about, recently I was seeing a video on the string theory. The whole basis of that string theory, or trying to understand string theory, is that idea that there is a unified field theory.
Right,
there's one thing that you can understand by which you can understand everything of the universe. And that's precisely what Vedanta speaks about. He's saying, I mean, that's the question that the father asks the son in, I think, Shvetashara Upanishad.
Bhrigu Valli,
I think. No? Where
Bhrigu Asvaruni.
Have you learned that by learning which you understand everything? That is what is unified field theory, right? And that is what it means. There is one thing, one scientific understanding. If you gain, you have understood everything else. And that was the approach of Vedas altogether. But if you look at it, it looks ridiculous in that sense. You know, in one hand, there is this insignificance of human life when you look at it from Copernicus' point of view, or the idea of how vast the universe is. The spirituality says that. It speaks about the vastness of the universe, and it speaks of the eternal nature of, you know, of truth itself. But at the same time, it says that in this finite is contained the infinite. And that is the understanding we are coming to now. That is the, I mean, that's precisely what, you know, the advanced science and quantum mechanics and all of that is coming to. And maybe at the time when Swami was speaking this, some of these might not have been so rampant in that sense.
Mm.
But the point which Swami made, it's so very significant. He says what was believed to be true now is disproved 10 years later. And that is the role of science. In fact, there was this one scientist who was saying that if you walk into a gathering of about 10 scientists or 15 scientists, that would probably be the most humble gathering we'll walk into. Because all true scientists are actually humble, because they know this fact that what they know today, they might disbelieve tomorrow. Because that is the nature of science. But it is only those who swear by science become arrogant, right?
Before we take a break, Prem, we refer to that sage and that Upanishadic story. And it's not Bhrguvalli, it is the story of Shvetaketu.
And Uddalaka, right?
Yes, and it actually resonates with what you made a concluding remarks about a true scientist being humble, because the story goes that the father tells him, Shvetaketu, my child, you're so full of your learning, and have you asked for that knowledge by which we hear the unhearable, by which we perceive the unperceivable, and we know the unknowable? And Shvetaketu asks, what is that knowledge? He says, as by knowing one lump of clay, all that is made of clay is known, so my child, it is that knowledge knowing which we know all. And the story goes on like that. But basically this whole conversation takes place because Shvetaketu is a genius and he picks up so much.
He comes back after 12 years of education.
Yes, and he says that I have learnt everything. And like you said, just that one statement is enough for the guru to know that, oh, you have not learnt anything. Because you have learnt everything, you will be so humble. You will be as humble as God, and we have seen how humble God can be. Because even when Swami would offer his, in quotes, ideas and opinions, which would ultimately turn out to be the best ones, he would always preface it by saying, in my opinion, possibly I think we can do like this. There's no need for him to say that, because that is the ultimate. But that is the humility of God. As Swami would say, God knows everything, but behaves like he knows nothing. Man knows nothing, but he behaves like he knows everything. So that was the story of Shvetaketu. On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, because the next question again Hislop asks, and it is a slightly different kind of question. So we'll take that after the break.
Sunlo. दिल की पुकार सुन लो हमको तुमसे प्यार कितना साईं तुम ही जानते
Niruleni chepare
पर दिए को तुमसे प्यार कितना
को तुमसे प्यार कितना
साही तुम ही जानते
Welcome back, dear listeners. Last week we played the instrumental of this track, and needless to say, all of you knew which song it was. And those of you who have not read the story, as we had promised last week, it's available on the website. It's definitely a wonderful read. I think you should go and read that. The genesis of this beautiful song, which we've heard so many times, sung by Swami students, devotees, and even Western devotees, do not probably understand the language, but so I mean, it's easy to connect to Swami through the song, so that story is available on the website. Please do go and read it if you have not yet read it. Coming back to the discussion that we're having right now, as we mentioned, there was this scientist who asked this question about science and spirituality, and Swami answered that by saying that science is fragmented and science is changing in its understanding every few decades, and I think that is known to all of us, even some of us who have gone through the schooling, because many, I don't know if we go back to some of the concepts we've read in science, how many of that has changed, has been updated, or has modified, in that especially the generation which is probably 1 year older to us would vouch for more of that, because many of this has changed so much drastically in the recent years, and that is the nature of science itself, and it's nothing to be nothing to point out at science. That is how science is. You update, you learn something, and you find that tomorrow what you've learned is incomplete. Then you update your knowledge. The only thing is, at the point of where you're speaking from, you need to be humble to understand that this is not complete. And this is probably not only for science, even for spirituality. What we would have sworn by 10 years ago, saying that this is what Swami means by saying this, I don't think we say the same thing. We have a better understanding of it. Thankfully, I mean, hopefully a better understanding of what we had 10 years back.
A different understanding, definitely.
Right, and that humility is what will make each one of us a learner. And that humility is what comes from gratitude, the previous point which Swami spoke about, that, you know, when you acknowledge that all of these people are contributing to your knowledge, to your learning, that will give you humility, and that humility will keep you a learner all the time. And that is what Swami mentions in this. And I think after that, Swami goes on to, there is no question. Yes, Swami, Islam is asking this question.
Yes.
Is there a reliable English translation of the Vedas? Because Swami did mention that the mantras are a means by which you take your prayers to where it needs to reach. And so he's asking, is there a reliable English translation of the Vedas? And Swami's answer to that is, the Vedas come from certain fundamental sounds and their variations. The slightest modification of the sound changes the meaning of what is said. No written language is able to represent all the Vedic sounds. It is impossible to write many of the words. The Vedas are God's breath and can be transmitted from person to person only by voice. In all of India, there are only a handful of people who can recite the Vedas correctly. some attempts have been made in recent years to write the Vedas and print them in books. The effort is wasted. This is what Swami says.
You know, that is why just today morning I happened to meet Vednarayan sir,
mm-hmm.
and he was saying how the devotees are yearning to learn, and he said that this year he is scheduled to go to some country, next year to Brazil, and Guatemala after that, and you know, even Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There is a reason why they want a teacher to come like that to teach, because as Swami says, it can't be learned from books. There might be books that are published, but there is a story, you know, told in the Taittiriya Samhita,
mm-hmm.
which goes like this. It is said that Tvashta, whose son was killed by Indra, he wanted to take revenge on Indra, and therefore he conducted a sacrifice to beget another son who would slay Indra. Now for that he had to chant the mantra which said Indra Shatru Vardhasva. Indra means Indra, Shatru means enemy, and Vardhasva is to kill. There's a reason why I'm not giving the full meaning, because the way you chant it determines the meaning. For instance, when you say Indra Shatru Vardhasva, when you take it higher, it means may Tvashta's son grow to be the enemy and killer of Indra. That's what it is.
Okay.
And the story narrates that instead of raising the Dra in Indra and raising the Shatru, Tru in Shatru, he chants it lower, something like Indra Shatru Vardhasva, something like that, you know, different. By lowering where it should have been higher. I really don't know if I did the exact mm-hmm. thing, but I'm not interested in the results there. Therefore, I'm just doing it as a sample. But instead of raising it, he lowers it. And the mantra now means, may Indra grow to be the killer of the son of Tvashta. So imagine Tvashta is wanting a son who will kill Indra, but he's chanting it in a manner which says, may Indra be the killer of the son who is going to be born. And ultimately, that's what happens. The child that is born grows demonic and tries to fight Indra and finally is killed by Indra himself. And he doesn't realize how Tvashta later on realizes how it was his own doing. He chanted it wrong and that's why it happened. This story is often narrated to show the importance of the intonations and of the incantations. Therefore, these intonations, however good it is written in the book. For example, I could not pronounce the mantra correctly, though I saw this Indra Shatru Vardhasva with the proper intonations in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, if somebody had told it and I had heard it, I'm sure that I would have been able to do better on afternoon satsang with that. So that is why Swami says Vedas, you can't capture them in a book. They have to be told as intonation. Like you said, one need not actually know the Vedas to please God. But if one is doing it, it is like it's like you want to travel from one place to another, you don't need a car to go, you can walk also. But if you're taking a car, you better know how to steer the car properly. In the same way, when we chant the Vedas, it is so important to know the intonations right. That's why, as our practice, whenever we have Vedam class or even when we chant Vedas, at the end of it, either silently or loudly, we chant that Kshama Prarthana.
Right.
Where we say that, Lord, please forgive. Because and this is something that even Vednarayan sir does, you know. It's not like anybody is immune to it. I heard someplace that the sin of chanting something in a wrong intonation is equal to the sin of killing one cow. And as students, we would often joke, when somebody chanted Vedam poorly, we would tell that, hey, when you chant, the whole Gokulam will get wiped out because all the cows will be dead there.
You'd say that he has a high CPS. Cows per second.
Cows per second, yes.
Somebody who chants badly.
So that's why there's a Kshama Prarthana also. Coming back to the point, it is so important that we get the intonations of these incantations right. The sounds and the variations have to be perfect. The slightest modification of the sound changes the meaning of what is said. That is what Swami is saying, and that is what that story also tells us. And that is the reason why you cannot get a reliable translation of the Vedas. And, you know, going back to that same story, when Swami says that you cannot get a reliable translation of the Vedas, even say that I am not writing the Sanskrit thing, but I am writing only the English translation. Now, if I were to write this story from the Taittiriya Samhita, how would I translate it into English? Would I say that Tvashta chanted this or Tvashta chanted that? To write what he chanted, I need to know what he chanted. So even the translation in English, the meaning will not hold good because the meaning itself depends on how it is chanted. And therefore the Vedas are something that have, that's why they are called the Shrutis. Shrutis means that which is heard. It has to be heard and learnt and transmitted that way orally.
You know, when you talk about language, you're asking about a translation. You know, language itself is a translation of thoughts into sounds that can be communicated, right? That's what it is. I'm thinking of something, and if I want to speak and communicate it to the listeners, I'm using English, right? That's what language is. But if you go back to what the Vedas are, and, you know, Swami has himself spoken about it extensively. In fact, the first Samukos, when Swami said that in 1970s that he wanted to start this Indian Samukos in Indian culture and spirituality. When they came and asked Swami, is there a specific theme that we should have it on? Swami said Indian culture is synonymous with Vedas and Vedanta. So it should be on the Vedas. And that's why I think in 1971 the first Samukos was on Vedas. And Swami has extensively spoken about it. And Swami would often say that, you know, these mantras and samhitas and brahmanas that you talk about as Vedic mantras, they were not composed by a person, but they were these rishis who sat in meditation and they achieved the feat of silencing the mind. And when the mind was silenced, they heard these mantras. And that's why another name for these rishis is mantra drashtas. They literally saw these mantras. They could see them when the mind was stilled. So which means these mantras were always there. These were in the form of sound and vibration, which were always there. And some people who had perfected the art of silencing the mind, you know, happened to see or hear these mantras. So you're talking about some vibrations which predated even human language. You know, when you talk about language, you talk about Sanskrit. It is a form of communication which was created after the humans started talking to each other. So you're talking about sounds which predated language. And we are trying to understand the meaning of something which is like that. And that is why sometimes if you go into some of these translations of Vedas, you would never be able to relate, right? You'll never be able to relate to that. You know, there are some sutras which go like, you know, give me the power of 10 bulls. And, you know, you might not be able to relate to that being a spiritual text at all.
We understand horsepower, not bull power.
Right. And, you know, I want many elephants and I want seeds for all, grains for all the, you know, the three generations of my children and all that, which might sound very materialistic. That's why Swami says that it can never do justice. You know, there has been attempts to translate the Vedas, but, you know, it's a wasted effort because the essence of the Vedas will never be translated in that manner.
Then Swami continues to speak after saying this. Swami says, the universe is a globe. Earth and all beings are smaller globes within that. The whole universe is held in Baba's hand. Forget the world. Give up the jiva. Reach God. Of the various sadhanas, repetition of the name of God is the most effective. If that is not done, karma is the next best. If no sadhana is done, then love of God is enough. With love of God, no discipline or practice is necessary.
If anybody was scared by whatever we've been speaking about now, the importance of intonation, the importance of, you know, saying it right and all of that, I think Swami is reminding us again that in this Kali Yuga, the most easy and the most sweet form of reaching the Lord is through Namasmarana. And you do not find that also effective, I mean, not effective, you do not relate to that approach. Swami says, then comes karma. The path of, you know, work is worship and duty is God, as Swami would say. But more supreme than all of that is the path of love. And that is why it is so very easy when the Lord comes in a human form, because that is the opportunity that the Lord gives. And that's what you've spoken extensively about in the Bhagavatam. You know, when God comes in a human form, otherwise it is so very difficult to love the abstract. You know, how can you have a love for somebody whom you say is beyond feelings, who is, you know, bhavatita, gunatita? So when that bhavatita, gunatita comes in a form, like we have had the opportunity to love, then loving God becomes so easy. And then Swami says, once you have love for God, no need any discipline, no need any sadhana. And I think that is the point where Swami is stopping this particular discussion. We'll take a break here, dear listeners. We'll play a short song for you. Don't go away. At the end of it, we'll continue this discussion that Swami is having with Hislop and other devotees.
कैसे जियूं मैं यूं तेरे बिन कैसे जियूं मैं यूं तेरे बिन तू जो नहीं तो तेरे बिन मेरा जी न लगे कैसे जियूं
Welcome back, dear listeners. We continue the conversation between Hislop and Swami, taken from his book, Conversations with God. A very interesting question that Hislop asks. He asks Swami, now, of course, all his questions have been interesting in one way or the other, but here goes. He asks, why does Baba have regular schools? Why not religious schools? So, in reply, Swami says, religious schools would appeal only to the religious, whereas Baba's task is to raise the general public into devotion and spiritual life. One aspect of Baba's task is to reform education, and if that were impossible, he would not have come. Now, having come, be assured the task will be accomplished, but not as fast as impatient humans would like. By an intensive television campaign, rapid change could be accomplished, but it would be only temporary. God sees things differently to man. and he knows that to start early, drive slowly and reach safely is correct. The change that Baba is bringing about may be through slow methods such as his colleges, but the methods will be effective.
I think, you know, when we are reading this today, we are reading it when Swami's University has 4 campuses. I think there are about 10,000 students who have graduated. And of course, it's very timely that we've just celebrated the alumni meet.
And we are at that point in time when Swami's alumni are heading many of the big institutions in India and across the world.
Absolutely. But you know, when this conversation was taking place in, I'm sure this was in old Vrindavan from the discussion.
1970s,
because, you know, later there's the description of boys hanging around the bungalow and all of that, because it's early 70s. And that was a time when the strength in the hostel was not even 100. It was at max, I think. I think maximum was 100 at that point in time. And, you know, it seemed pretty much waste of the avataric time for somebody like Swami to spend the entire day with students. And in fact, that was a period when Swami was spending much of the year in Vrindavan. He would just come to Patti for celebrations. It's very difficult for us to understand how Swami spaces out his time. And, you know, it looks like, Swami, you could do much, much more this time that you're spending with these college boys, you know, who probably are not going to come back and give you monetarily in any way. You might as well spend this time with the leaders of the world and, you know, the ministers. And oftentimes we've seen that, so many students would have this experience of Swami spending so much time with students when there are people of such great influence sitting outside in the corridor. Or Swami might come in the portico, or Swami might be in the bhajan hall speaking so much time, standing and speaking to 9th standard, 10th standard and graduate students when there were ministers sitting outside. And it's not that Swami did not give them the time, but the way Swami spent his time, it's very difficult for us to understand. And, you know, I think when we were doing that Satyam Shivam Sundaram also, we were saying that it looks like Swami's choices were all not very intelligent in that sense. But the approach which Swami took was something which, you know, only somebody who has such supreme confidence in his ways can go about the way he did. And that's what Swami is talking about here. My ways are very, very different. And yes, you could have a TV campaign, you could have in the modern parlance, you could have a social media campaign and
marketing blitz.
Right, marketing blitz. You could have a blast, you can have everybody know about it. And Swami says, my ways are very, very different.
In fact, I remember one of the speakers in Kulwant Hall mentioning about how Swami had said that Mother Yashoda, when she had to catch Krishna, she would show butter in one hand, hiding the stick with which she wanted to discipline him for all the naughty things, all the mischievous things that he's doing, hiding it behind her back. And the logic is pretty simple, because if Krishna, little baby Krishna, sees the stick, he will not come near the mother. Therefore, show the butter, but once he comes near to take the butter, then catch him and give the stick. And Swami said that is what I'm doing with my students as well. I seem to be offering them courses, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, an MBA, an M.Tech, and, you know, a doctorate, all these things. But those are all akin to the butter in the hand of Mother Yashoda. They are just used to attract them here, because what I wish to give them is the stick of Atma Vidya that will wake them up from their slumber. I want to give Atma Vidya. But if I were to show that Atma Vidya is the reason why I'm calling you here, nobody would come to the university. How true it is, because I remember as a student when I came to Swami's school, the sole objective was to get a good education with Swami so that I can become a doctor. Today when I see myself in the position that I am, I feel that it is all because of Swami's love and grace that poured through Swami's educational institution, through Swami's teachers, that molded my way of thinking, that, you know, reprogrammed my priorities, that opened my eyes to the reality. And I'm so grateful for this. I'm so grateful that, Swami, you didn't grant my prayer with which I came here. I'm so grateful for all the prayers that have been refused, because Swami's methods are slow and it is like that. And therefore, you know, it is so much more relevant for us at Radio Sai here, because we also at different levels or with different convictions feel that we need to spread Swami's message as far as possible and as fast as possible. I think this gives us a good good kind of yardstick, good way to measure our efforts, because Swami says it's about starting early, driving slowly and reaching safely. It's about the task of being patient, in the sense that if we don't evolve through the work that we are doing at Radio Sai here, it is of no use, because that is what Swami said when he came to Radio Sai also. He said that I have got no sambandham with all this. I have got no interest in all this. But if it is going to help you evolve, you can definitely work here. So we should always keep in mind that I am working here at Radio Sai primarily for me to go closer to Swami and me to evolve. That is why I will be, I will do, then I will tell. I am not here to change the world. And that holds true for everybody, whether they are working in Central Trust or in the canteen or in the hospitals, in the different state organizations, in any other multinational corporation, any other place that they are working. The ultimate objective is to grow closer to God and go closer to our ultimate destination. In the process, the world will automatically get transformed. Our focus should not begin with "let me transform the world."
And you know, Swami is saying very clearly here that, you know, God sees things differently to man, and he knows that to start early, drive slowly and reach safely is correct, right? And you know, when Swami tells us that this is how you have to pace your spiritual life, that you have to start at an early age and you have to be patient with your progress and then reach safely, Swami is saying that that's precisely what I do too. And to the question, you know, many times when we talk about the Institute, we must have mentioned this in other discussions too, I would often think that if I had read the mission statement of the Institute, probably I wouldn't have been here. Mm-hmm. You know, when you say that Swami tells that this is the butter that Swami is holding out and the stick is hidden behind, many of us wouldn't have been here if we had read the mission statement of the Institute. Because Swami says that very, very clearly, right? I just have it here in front of me. I'll just read that out. Mm. Swami says, "The Institute has not been established just to prepare you for earning degrees. Teaching you the university curricula, preparing you for the university examinations, and awarding you university degrees, these are only means employed for the end, namely spiritual uplift, self-discovery, and social service through love and detachment. Hmm. Our objective is to provide the youth with an education which, while cultivating their intelligence, will also purify their impulses and emotions and equip them with the physical and mental disciplines needed for drawing upon the springs of calmness and joy that lie within their own hearts.
Wow.
Our hope is that by their lives, they will be shining examples of spiritual awareness and its beneficial consequences to the individual and the society." And Swami has made it very, very clear, you know, when this is only a means, this is not the ends. And that's why Swami would say that you could complete your education in the university, but it doesn't mean that you have graduated as Swami's students completely. And that's why, you know, we just had the alumni meet. When I remember when the first few alumni meets were being done, when the cards used to go to Swami, they used to write old students or, you know, old Sai students or something like that. Swami would say, "What is this, old students?" Right? All are students. And that's why the alumni body is still called Sathya Sai students. It is not called Sathya Sai alumni or Sathya Sai old students. Hmm. Because Swami was, one, he was saying that all of you are students. Once a student, you're always a student. But the other thing is,
You've still not
graduated from being a Swami student, because Swami has clearly said what it means to be, that you should have reached the ultimate. That is what is the ultimate graduation for a Sai student.
We move on to the next question, where Hislop asks, "What should we do about young people to correct their character and behavior?" And Swami says, "A child is bound to touch a hot lamp until one's burned. Young people are without balance and they want immediate results. For example, yesterday there was a marriage here. The young man wanted a son at once. He did not wish to wait for 9 months. a guru, so-called, comes into view and the young people flock to him hoping for quick self-realization. But once disappointed, they turn away and in the process gain some caution and patience.
Right.
So, Swami is saying that, when we think about building young people, correcting their character and behavior, Swami is again making it very clear, categorically he is stating that it is not something that you achieve very quick. You need patience, you need to do it slowly. And if you are in a hurry, in fact Swami would say hurry, worry, curry are the three main causes of heart problems. So if you are in a hurry, you will not be able to achieve anything. I remember when we had a satsang, some of the parents actually asked this question as to what we should do. We would love our children to love Swami and, you know, follow his teachings and attend all the things of the ACT center, everything. But they don't seem to be interested what to do. You know, I was just thinking deeply and just as an inspired thought it came that I cannot expect my child to do what I am not doing. It holds good even for spirituality. If I don't want my little daughter to spend more time on the television or the phone screen or the iPad screen, I should myself spend less time. Because now children, as they grow and as they learn to talk. You know, now my daughter asks me, why are you seeing your phone when you tell me that I should not see it while I'm having food? And it hits me, you know, and I know that, oh, she's observing, she's... Which means very fast they learn, children learn, they're intelligent, and if they see that their parents are hypocrites, they will not care even the slightest for the words of the parents. If I need my child to follow my words, I need to follow my own words. Which means, rather the other way, rather than me following my words, I should do and then speak about what I'm doing. I should preach only after I have practiced. And that is the surest way to communicate. I myself say that I am going to work, I have lots of work, I can't attend bhajans, but I want my child to attend bhajans instead of playing. The child will say that I want to play, I don't have time for bhajans. And I will tell, what playing? You attend bhajans. For the child, in his or her mind it is, what work you are talking about, you attend bhajans then. I mean, I feel that it is justified that I have to go to work, I have important meetings, I have to do this, I have to do that, so many responsibilities on me, and therefore I can't attend bhajans. In the child's world, it seems equally justified in saying, I have got games to play, I have friends to meet, I have to do all this, I can't attend bhajans. But I feel you meeting your friends is waste. In fact, when we talk to Swami or when we sit in the divine presence, we realize that Swami is telling us the same thing. All your career, your imaginary things, all this is all a total waste. But I feel it's most important. We just graduate from liking a 60 rupee car to liking a 60 lakh rupee car. That's all. The size of our toys have grown, but we have not grown at all. And that truth is easily perceived by the children. And therefore, if I want to change the child, I need to perceive the truth and I need to be an inspiring personality. That is why, you know, we all learned from Swami. Because what an inspiration Swami is. Everything that he spoke, he did much more than that. In fact, he spoke less than what he is doing. That's why he was an inspiration. Because he was being much more than what he was doing. And he was doing much more than what he was telling. And therefore, everything that he said made such a deep impact on us. And I think that is a take-home lesson for all of us, you know, whether we are parents or not. There are children who are learning from adults. When we are adults, if we want the children to follow the right path, we have to be on the right path, we have to do the right things, and then only tell them.
And yeah, the diagnosis or, you know, whatever Swami is pointing out as the basis for the problem with the new generation. And in fact, it is the problem which we carry on to, you know, to the point when we become the senior generation, that is impatience, right? And Swami is, of course, I'm sure that man who just got married the previous day didn't say that he wants a child immediately, but Swami is making a very, very profound point there. You know, when Swami is saying that, we know it's very absurd. Somebody who gets married today, he wants a child the very day. You're prepared to wait for a child for 9 months, which is just a worldly child, which is, even at the point of birth, the child is not going to do anything more than just being there, right? You're prepared to wait 9 months for a child and probably wait for another 20 years before that child, you know, achieves something and gives you real joy in that sense. You're prepared to wait so much for absolute, after all, one child which is being born to you. Swami is saying, but you don't have that patience when it comes to spiritual understanding. You go to a guru and you want immediate peace. You know, the next day onwards you should be peaceful. You come to Swami, you go to the Sai Center for the first time, and you immediately want all your problems to be, you know, blown away. You immediately want to feel the calm and peace, and you want to sit down and meditate. I think that is the mistake that we do. And by referring to this particular absurd idea of somebody wanting a child the day one gets married, Swami is referring to that. How can it be that when you come to a spiritual gathering, or when you just take to the spiritual path, you find that, you know, oh, I'm not able to do meditation. In fact, you know, there was this old student who was saying, he joined Swami's college, and, you know, first few months were like being in heaven. He was saying that he would sit in the early morning hours and he would go into meditation, and almost half an hour, 45 minutes, undisturbed meditation, and you could constantly think of Swami and all of that. And it lasted for about 3 months, and after that, everything went haywire. Right, he was not able to think of Swami, his mind was running all over the place, he was sitting for bhajans and he was not able to do. And finally he said, you know, I can't take this any longer, because he felt that if he had been like that all through, it was fine. You know, that first few months Swami gave him the joy of, you know, enjoying that peace, and he felt that, you know, something is going wrong with him. So he wrote a letter to Swami, and, you know, I think those days you could pass it on through that door boy, one boy used to do that duty. You could go and give it to him, and students and staff had that opportunity. And Swami was staying in the mandir, right, above the bhajan hall. So he went and gave it to, he did not want to give it in public, right, because he felt that if Swami reads it in front of everybody and starts discussing the problem, then, you know, it's very embarrassing. Right? By then probably you would have already earned the name of, here's the boy who does meditation early in the morning. And, you know, that's the funny thing. I was telling some devotees when I was talking, we had this very weird relationship with Swami. When we stood in front of him, we knew that he knows everything. He knows everything that goes in our mind, but still we would write letters to him. But there were some things which we didn't want him to talk openly. We wanted it to be only heart to heart. Right? It's a very weird kind of a relationship which cannot be expressed in words. So this boy writes this letter, doesn't want to give it in darshan time, but wants it to reach Swami, because that gives you peace of mind that I've informed Swami. And you don't want Swami to discuss to you about it in public, right? So he gave this letter to this boy and he ran away from that. You know, he didn't want Swami to ask for him or discuss the topic. But the next day, I think Swami comes and asks him, calls him for an interview, and he's like shivering. He said, oh God, did I write more than I should have written in that letter and all that? And then Swami asks him, what is your problem? Why are you so troubled? So then he pours out again whatever he had written in the letter, I think. And then Swami tells him, he said, do you think it's for no reason that the great sages and saints have given up all worldly pursuits and they've gone and sat in the Himalayas or places which are like that in the forest for hundreds of years and they're doing meditation? By sitting for 3 months or 4 months, do you think you can master the same level of meditation or concentration? He says, be patient. It takes a lot of time. After all, for a degree, you're ready to be patient so much. This is... you're asking for something which is beyond the world. So be patient with yourself, and that patience is the basis of the spiritual path itself. So when Swami is saying that, you know, you have to recognize that impatience is the disease, you should also recognize that as parents and teachers and counselors or whatever, we are also being impatient with, you know, the wards in that sense.
Actually, Swami goes on to give another little story, but I think that will take some time, and therefore we will stop at this point. The time in our studios is 1:57, and very little time to go before Chandu can come in with his segment. So we will stop right here, offer this with all our humility and love at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And we hope, dear listeners, that you enjoyed this. We will be continuing it after a fortnight, because the next fortnight we will be taking up some general topics. So we'll leave you now with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
दे।